Hi, everybody. We're live. We missed you all.
Mm-hmm. We did. But John and I assume, John, you had a relaxing time on Long Island?
It was nice. Pretty okay weather.
Good.
I
saw a lot of bird pictures.
Do we get any kind of vacation dump here for like a technical side of it, or is it just...
I did record a Rectifs last night. I didn't even get to vacation results in Rectifs yet because we, in typical fashion, got derailed onto other things. But I will eventually have vacation results on Rectifs. But for here, no, there's no real tech updates, I don't think.
Yeah, cameras held up. Everything worked the way you wanted
yeah,
it.
Yeah, although I think I might have... I've either lost my camera lens cleaning kit in the house or I left it there because I was going to clean my cameras today and I couldn't find my kit. It's just like a little, you know, microfiber cloth and lens cleaning solution. Like, it's not expensive stuff, so I just ordered some new stuff.
Wait, don't you wear glasses?
From B&H, in fact. I ordered it in the hopes that as soon as I placed the order, I would find it in the house, and that didn't work.
Don't you wear glasses?
I do.
Okay, I've been wearing glasses for like 2 seconds and I already have like the huge box of Zeiss lens wipes, and I use one almost every day.
I know. I don't use fancy camera quality lens wipes on my glasses.
They're the same wipes, the Zeiss lens wipes.
I know. I don't use any lens wipes on my glasses. I use water. I use water on my glasses and soap.
No.
That seems nuts to me.
I've been wearing glasses since fourth grade. It's perfectly fine, I assure you.
You're looking through smears all the time.
I'm not looking through smears. My glasses are pristine. My family is looking through smears because they don't even clean their glasses. They make me clean their glasses for them because I don't think they even know how, and they get sick of looking through smears. My glasses are very clean.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad your vacation results were good. We did a good job this year and scheduled our vacations concurrently, definitely on purpose. Definitely on purpose.
Oh, I have one vacation result relevant to this show. Marco cursed me with all of the eye-stinging sunscreen thing because I'm like, oh, you know, yeah, it does sting if you get it in your eyes, but I'm usually pretty careful. That doesn't happen. I got the worst eye stinging of my entire life on this vacation in, like, my left eye only on one particular day. I have no idea what happened differently that day, but I think for next year I got to get some of that fancy stuff.
Oh, you're going to come around. Mm-hmm.
And you cursed me. It was like, you know, it's normally like, oh, it gets in your eyes if you're not careful, and it's just a little stinging. And remember I talked about, like, well, some people, you made it seem like some people maybe don't feel the stinging, or you may feel it worse than other people. I don't know if any of that is true. All I know is this was the worst thing I've ever felt in my entire life from sunscreen. It's the same sunscreen I've been using for, like, a decade, right? And just it was a disaster. I'm like, well, no, that's, you know, this is a sign.
I got news for you. Every sunscreen available in the U.S. will have exactly the same problem.
I know.
Thanks, autobenzone.
Yeah, I'm aware. Like, I'm aware of the stinginess. I'm very familiar with the stinginess. But normally, it's like, oh, just I got a tiny little bit, a tiny little sting towards the end of the day when you get sloppy with the sweat or whatever. But like, this was just this. First of all, was not at the end of the day. It was early in the day, and it was terrible.
It only takes one little slip up, one misplaced finger or wiped edge, or
yeah,
even
I don't even know what happened.
Sweat.
It's like cutting hot peppers and rubbing your eyes. Like, at least you know what happened there. I don't even know what happened this time, but it was bad.
Sometimes you don't know. Also, it can migrate. It's really fun.
Yeah, I've heard about the migration.
Yeah, it's amazing. And yes, we know about mineral sunscreen. That has its own trade-offs. We talked about it a few episodes ago. Please don't write it.
Yeah, no, I'd rather have my eye sting than have that damage to my car.
Yeah. Honestly, maybe
me
too.
The eye feels better, but the car never recovers.
So honestly, like since I have been using the Japanese sunscreen, it has radically changed my relationship to sunscreen. Like, now I am putting it on every day. I'm reapplying. If I put it on in the morning and I go out in the afternoon, I have worn more sunscreen in the last 2 weeks than I have probably in the last 5 years, because it becomes like, oh, there's no downside anymore. Like, every other sun, it's major downsides for every other kind that's available in the U.S. And this has just had, oh, there's no downsides. It's like wearing moisturizer. It's fine. You just put it on. It's fine. Life changing.
All right. Before we get started, we should at least acknowledge the. Sorry, we should acknowledge. I'm going to try to get through this without vomiting all over myself.
We don't need the Foley work.
All right. Well, I tried. We need to acknowledge Tim kissing the ring yet again. It's so freaking gross. I hate this so much. I
you have a little bit of admiration for making a gold trinket. I have a little bit of admiration for that.
I hate it. I hate it. I hate it.
It's so transparently kindergarten. He likes shiny things. Get him something gold. When does Apple ever make anything gold aside from the Apple Watch edition?
I mean, can we Can we drop like the pretense that a lot of Apple commentators have that this is all part of some big strategy and he has to do this? Like, he's obviously...
He doesn't have to, but he's choosing to do it.
Yeah, this is direct support and ass-kissing. Direct, like, there is no... Tim Cook is clearly a Trump supporter, and...
He's not. You can't stop with that. Oh, my God. He's not.
What's the difference? Between, the difference would be
that he would have campaigned for Trump to get elected, and he would have been at rallies, jumping up in the air, and making a giant X with his body, and he would have been... You know, donating hundreds of million dollars to the campaign to get him elected before he was president. He would have expressed support for the president for him when he was running for president both times. He would be constantly saying how much he loves Trump and loves everything he does, yada, yada, yada. Now he's kissing his butt because he thinks that's what he needs to do as part of his job. You can disagree with that, but he doesn't actually like Trump. He doesn't actually support Trump, but he is debasing himself to essentially bribe our corrupt president and our corrupt system, embarrassing himself and our country and all Apple supporters kiss up to this idiot. That's what's happening.
Okay, so that's a very generous read, but I urge everyone out there who's trying to bend over backwards into the shape that you would have to be to kiss your own butt, trying to defend Tim Cook here, I want you to really consider, like, why are you working so hard to try to excuse this as obviously not him actually being a Trump supporter? When he gave him $1 million for the inauguration, he was there with all the other, you know, tech billionaires who everyone says are obviously Trump supporters. Like, he's there doing all the same things that all these other people are doing. He's directly supporting him with money and gifts and trinkets and support and you know, public endorsement, effectively, like, you know, publicly doing things with him. So I urge you to consider, like, how is that different from support? I honestly don't see a huge difference.
Well, you see the difference in motivation. Why are you doing it? And in this case,
we don't know the motivation. He is
right. Well, but it's pretty obvious what it is. But
is
just,
it?
You know, yeah.
No,
I think
see
it is.
What it is. So and before, when he gave the $1 million, when it was just Tim Cook personally giving him the $1 million, then we could all say, oh well, it's distancing it from Apple. This is Apple. This is an Apple logo on a gift made of gold sitting on Trump's desk. Like, I think that's actually a fairly clever manipulation, though.
Don't you think that's really clever manipulation?
No, I think it's direct support.
Well, so here's
and
the thing.
It looks bad for. So I'll tell you a quick little story here. When I went to go pick up my kid from camp, it was a nerd camp, and so I always wear nerdy shirts when I go to, because there's like, you know, like a little, like, you know, adult, you know, little ceremony opening and closing for the camp. So it's an audience full of nerds. So I always wear my nerdiest shirts. And in the past, I have worn Apple shirts, and I actually put on an Apple shirt, like, you know, some Apple shirt I got from the visitor center over the years. Like, they have pretty fun designs. So I put on an Apple T-shirt, and I'm like, you know what, actually, I don't think I can wear this right now, because Apple in the past, the brand of Apple used to be neutral to liberal and pretty widely accepted. Today, I don't think it is. Today, Tim Cook and Apple now are directly cooperating with, supporting, and sucking the ass of Donald Trump. And so the brand damage that is happening here, not to mention the fact that it's a huge middle finger to all of Apple's employees who do not agree with this, which is many of them, and all the groups of people that Trump is actively committing violence against who also happen to work for Apple. This is unconscionable. And why? Now, the last time everyone said, oh, well, obviously Tim Cook wants to make sure Apple survives the tariffs and everything. And that's part of it. By the way, those are problems that Tim Cook created. But okay, that's part of it. But also, Tim Cook wants the Justice Department out of Apple's business. They don't want regulation. They don't want antitrust. Like, there's a lot behind this. Also, Tim Cook's a billionaire. When we don't question why other billionaires support Trump, it's obvious. It's for money and power reasons. Tim Cook might have those same reasons. We don't know. We don't know that much about Tim Cook. So what I'm saying is, not only is Tim Cook obviously directly supporting Trump the same way lots of other billionaire CEOs do, and we didn't try to defend them at all, but also he has roped Apple in so much that he is doing profound damage to Apple's brand. It's time for Tim to go. What are we waiting for?
I agree with you. I agree with you on that point, but for different reasons. But I have to say, like, in this particular case, what he's, you know, his little dog and pony show and his little bribe and everything is actually about a thing that Apple was doing anyway and is a good thing in this case, like putting money into U.S. manufacturing. Like, it's not that big of a deal. Like, again, we talked about this the first time they did this, that in the previous year, Apple had made basically the same exact press release with an inflation-adjusted amount that is the same amount. But either way, Apple investing in U.S. manufacturing is a thing Apple should be doing and is a good thing that I think we can all agree is a good thing. So that is what is actually being done here. The embarrassing part is obviously doing a dog and pony show in public with Trump, which is essentially, you know, supporting him and lending him Apple's name, and then giving him the gold trinket thing, which is a very low-cost bribe in the grand scheme of things, because it is, instead of having to give him $1 million, you can give him a gold trinket that he'll be just as happy about, and is probably more effective when you're, you know, bribing the idiot dictator. Bribing the idiot dictator is
a cost to the brand.
Yeah, well, so we'll see what the cost of the brand is long term. Obviously, this is not good for the brand.
They might as well have made a gold swastika in Nazi Germany. Like, honestly, what's the difference?
Right. So that's, you know, it's we'll see what the brand damage is. I don't think it's going to be beneficial, but how much damage really depends on how much people pay attention to this and, you know, the specifics of Apple doing this versus all the other people who are kissing up to it. To give an example, I would think that the reputational damage to Columbia University is worse than Apple has endured so far with its bribe. So Tim continues to try to walk that line. But yeah, in the end, the motivations don't matter.
The line. He fell over the line.
Yeah,
backwards to suck Donald Trump's ass.
We'll see, because Apple is reaping benefits from these bribes. I mean, they are avoiding some of the worst of the tariff stuff and getting exemptions for things. And you know, it's a terrible situation. Our country is in a bad situation, and this is how Tim Cook is dealing with it. And I don't think he should be CEO anymore, but not for this specific reason. But it's certainly on the pile of reasons. But if we had a different CEO who was acting differently and was stridently against it or whatever, there'd be other harms to Apple from that as well. And, you know, maybe that's the better way to go. But there's no really good. There's no win scenario in this. It's just a series of loss scenarios, and it depends on what kind of loss you're willing to endure. What damage are you willing to do to what parts of what things and which people? And obviously, Marco disagrees with the damage that Tim is choosing to inflict on Apple and its employees and its reputation. But Tim seems to think this is the right thing to do. Anyway, he should go for other reasons. But, you know, whatever reasons you have for wanting Tim Cook to step aside and let someone else run the show, if we can all agree on that, then we're making some progress.
See, Tim Cook, he knows exactly as much about Apple's brand as he does about computers, software, and design. Why is this man running this company?
I mean, I think he's running this. God help me for defending him, because I think this is disgusting, but you've put me in this position,
explaining why something is happening is not defending it.
Well,
right.
Okay,
I think it's two different things there. Like, I disagree with Marco about why this is happening, but I agree with him that it's bad.
Yes, exactly. So the reason this is happening is because Tim Cook is the head of this giant ass company with thousands upon thousands of employees. And he knows that to some degree, this company is screwed if he doesn't bend over and kiss the ring.
But are they? Yes. Like, can we challenge that for a minute? Because that's what everyone, I'm not saying that you are wrong. That's what everyone else is saying, too. But what would the actual damage be if Apple had to pay the tariffs like everyone else does? First of all, wouldn't that just be fair? Second of all, like, okay, their prices would go up. They would take a hit to margin. Their stock price might suffer a little bit. They're not going to go out of business. We're all going to still have iPhones. You know, like every tariff, the cost would be mostly borne by the public. The public who, by the way, voted for this guy. So they kind of deserve it. That's what we're talking about. And the Department of Justice would probably continue its, you know, various investigations towards various anti-competitive and monopolistic behavior
that
Apple does.
I think they're going to do that anyway, by the way. I don't think they're getting out of the DOJ stuff, no matter how much they bribe.
Oh, we'll see how that goes. That's to be determined, right? But certainly, I guarantee you that's part of this. But, like, so that's what everyone is arguing, who's saying that Tim Cook has to do this for various strategic or financial reasons, what you're arguing is that participating in direct support of this Nazi dictator is a better idea than taking a couple of quarters of a stock price hit because they would be subject to the same rules that literally every company would be subject to.
No, you're putting some words in my mouth here, and I understand why, because if I were in your shoes, I'd probably say the same thing. But what I'm saying to you is, it is Tim's responsibility to do right by Apple. And I agree with you, Marco, that I think I would like to think I would make different choices, but ultimately he is responsible to do right by Apple. That his literally his job is to do right by Apple. And when he looks at the chessboard in front of him, the way you do right by Apple is give the toddler in the Oval Office a shiny toy to play with. I agree with you. It's disgusting. It's deplorable. I hate every bit of it. I'm not arguing any of that, but I can absolutely see that if I'm Tim and if I am willing to do whatever it takes to make Apple successful, then I'm doing this. Now, I don't think I would make that same choice. I think I would say, well, you know what? Tough nuts. This is the world the American public somehow voted for. So this is where we are. But that's why I'm not Tim Cook. Right. And I think that his actions, while I simultaneously find them deplorable, are extraordinarily explicable.
Yeah, I mean, having to be subject to the same rules as everyone else. It's a situation where all the other big tech companies are doing essentially the same thing. And if everyone else is doing the wrong thing and Apple sits it out and does the right thing, presumably they would suffer more than their competitors. So whatever hit that we think it would be, and maybe Tim Cook has numbers on this and we just have speculation about what it would actually be. But whatever damage it would be magnified by the fact that they would be a standout in a company that is not kissing his butt. But I think the universities have shown that trying to kiss his butt is a losing proposition. Yeah. So far it's been working better for Tim Cook than it has for the universities, because universities that bent over backwards and said, yeah, we'll do whatever you want, they just have more and more demands, right? Whereas Apple and Tim, again, with one of his greatest skills, as we've discussed in the past, is knowing how to deal with dictators from his experience with China, right? Knowing how to deal with governments that are, not working according to the normal rules. So, yeah, I think he thinks he's navigating this well. History will see how well he is actually navigating it. There are a lot of risks here. The risks probably outweigh the short-term benefits, but soon Marco will be soon Tim Cook will be retired, and it'll be the next person's problem.
Yeah, he can tank the company's reputation and then just pass it along. Great, good job as American CEO. That's perfect.
All right, let's move on. Let's do some follow-up. HGTV test has done things. I don't think anyone cares, but John, so let's move on.
Nope. Done things. This is important to Marco about the TVs.
I'm kidding.
This is my favorite TV reviewer, Vincent Teo from HGTV test. He got around to reviewing the Sony Bravia A2 and also the Panasonic Z95B. And so we'll link to those two reviews in the show notes, because I hadn't heard from him on those two things. He's my favorite reviewer, even if I don't always exactly agree with him. I like the way he approaches things, and he always has lots of good information. Related to that, there was the TV shootout results, the Value Electronics TV shootout that The Verge and Ali Patel participates in.
Hold on. You're skipping something important here, sir.
What am I skipping?
Now that's how the tables have turned. Ha ha. Mm-hmm. Almost immediately, and to your credit, you did note this in our internal show notes, but almost immediately in the HGTV test review of the Bravia 8.2, he says the Bravia 8 what?
I didn't note that. Margo did. Bravia 8 Mark II, but he's he lives in the UK, so
I didn't note anything.
Weird things.
I think Casey
put that in and forgot.
I probably
that he put
did.
It in
that's probably true, because this was like 2 weeks ago. But yes, that's probably true. And yes, he did say the Sonya is apparently what I put in our show notes. Wow. Yep. Anyway, Sony Bravia 8 Mark II, which, if you recall, a certain co-host of mine, John, was making merciless fun of me for calling my AirPods Pro Mark IIs.
You're not from the UK, and that's not what the company calls it. And also, he says Panasonic Z95B. You want to start saying Z?
No, that's ridiculous. But I'm taking the W on the Mark II.
Anyway.
All right.
So in the TV shootout, the shocker headline from The Verge was like, actually, they put the word shock in there. Inside the LG G5, shocking last place finish. So I just give some context on that. There were four televisions in the shootout. It was the Sony Bravia 8 II, the Samsung S95F, the Panasonic Z95B, and the LG G5. And the LG G5 came in last place, which means fourth place against the other top three TVs. And you can read the article to explain why. I'm here to say that having seen both of these reviews from Vince Teo on the Sony Bravia 8 II and the Panasonic Z95B, my recommendation to Marco is still the LG G5, because the Bravia 8 II just isn't better enough than the A95L and has lots of weird compromises, especially when it comes to gaming. Samsung is out because of no Dolby Vision. I don't like how they handle colors. The Panasonic is weird and doesn't flush mount against the wall very well and has a speaker on the bottom, and I think it's ugly. And the LG G5 is just brighter than all of them. It does HDIG really well. Marco's familiar with the LG interface, and it's a really good TV. And so that's why it is still my recommendation for Marco. And I would personally probably get the Bravia 8 Mark II. I would not get the Panasonic because it's too ugly and I hate their fire interface thing, but it's actually a decent TV. But yeah, the LG G5 is just brighter than all of them. And I have faith that LG will continue to update its firmware to deal with whatever issues were causing it to end up in last place on this thing. They already did fix the firmware problem that was causing it to lose out to some other TVs earlier. So they are fast on their feet. Still my recommendation for Marco's specific case, LG G5. It wall mounts real easily. It looks real good. It has the LG interface you like. It gets real bright, and it's an OLED.
So one other point to add to the pile. So I do have an LG OLED, that, you know, whatever, like the C7, the 2017 one, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I forget whether it's C5 or C7, whatever it is, like one of those. And that has been fine, but that was a long time ago. My more recent TVs are the Samsung frames, which are terrible. One of them already has a giant blue stripe through it. They were even terrible when they were new and working perfectly. Anyway, those are the ones that I'd be looking to replace, at least one of them. The Samsung frame, the other day, as I was watching a show, put up a big notification in the upper right corner saying something like, our privacy policies have been updated. And I had to dismiss it. I had to dig out the Samsung remote, which I never use. I'm just using the Apple TV remote usually. Find the Samsung remote and dismiss this thing from the overlay, from the upper right, third of my screen. What I would like... Now, I also Samsung's interface, also, even when it is not bothering me about that kind of stuff, the interface they have to switch inputs is the most convoluted. It basically has its own app list on the bottom, across the bottom of the home screen, because it's trying to be the smart TV. And to switch inputs, you can't just push one button on every TV that came before it. You have to hit whatever the home menu button is and navigate through that giant menu, which as it very slowly tries to load whatever the hell it's trying to load. I've never had a TV that I've hated more than my Samsung TV. Now, at the restaurant, there are two other Samsung TVs. They are just as annoying, and they're from different times. So I have to imagine that, that whatever the 5-year-old one I have in my house here, and then however old the restaurant ones are, I have to imagine this is a thing that Samsung is probably, presumably, still doing. Whatever TV,
I don't like Samsung's interfaces either.
Whatever TV I get next, I don't care if it has smart features or not. I wouldn't use them, probably. I want to be able to turn off any of that complexity and just, let me switch inputs with a button on the remote.
Can you do that on your current LG?
I think so.
I mean, I'm not as familiar with the new LG interfaces, but I think if you could do it on your C7, you should be able to do it. I know I can do it on the Sony one. It's just a single button. It's input, although I rarely press it because I have a receiver, so it's always on the same input. But, I know I can do it on the Sony, and I'm assuming on the current Sonys you can do it. I recommended LG to you because you've been using the LG interface, and it hasn't been driving you nuts. So,
well, I never
I hope you can
it.
Turn things off on that.
Yeah.
I mean, which all the TVs good. Are smart TVs. There's actually a video from Vincent Teo of HGTV Test on how to turn off all the things on the Sony thing, turn off all the apps, turn off all the information gathering. It makes the interface faster if you use that interface, which I don't. But there are things you can turn off, and I'm presumably in LG there's other places where you can turn things off. But yeah, there's no getting around the fact that every TV is a smart TV. There is no such thing as a dumb TV for consumers that you can buy that has as good a picture as the ones we're describing here.
Yeah, but all this is to say, even if Samsung made the best option available, I would never buy it because I hate using Samsung TVs so much.
And they don't, so don't worry. You're
good.
Safe.
But so all this is to say, like, the exact best specs, if the number one model has an annoying interface and the number two model doesn't, I would pick the number two model, even if it's not quite as good as specs, just because I've learned that's a thing that matters to me.
Yeah, that's one of the things that soured me on Panasonic is they do have a, I don't know if it's just, you know, this was in the, I don't know if it's just in the UK, but anyway, you use the Fire TV interface, which I really dislike. And they used to roll their own, which was very minimal and I kind of enjoyed, but yeah, you know, Sony uses Google, which I find passable. But again, I don't use, like you, I don't, like, I never see the smart TV interface ever. So it doesn't really matter what it does as long as it doesn't present itself to my face. So again, I still say LG G5, get a return policy if the software has really annoyed you, but form factor wise and performance wise, I think that is your pick. And second pick, if you can't tolerate that one, is I go with the Sony Bravia 8 because I know their interface and it is, fairly unobtrusive.
That's glowing reviews. All right, let's talk Apple Care One. Dave Penn writes, a Reddit user called uIndependent6915 has created an app called iCare Calculator, currently in test flight, that you should take a look at. So reading from that Reddit post, that person's Reddit post, I made a small iOS app called iCare Calculator. It's now available in test flight. Just add all your Apple devices to the list, and the app will recommend the most cost-effective plan, showing a quick monthly price comparison between Apple Care Plus and Apple Care One. When possible, it even recommends a smart split that combines both plans to help you save even more money. Then there was a different link where that, or
that was a link to the, I was trying to save you from all of that, which I think you added in. That was in the Reddit link. If you follow it, you'll find out, oops, it's been removed by the mods for whatever subreddit reason. And apparently the mods said that kind of post is not allowed. And everyone in that Reddit thread, the post has been removed, but the comments are still there. Everyone in the Reddit thread said, this should be a website instead of an app. So the test flight doesn't work anymore. Test flight link doesn't work anymore. I don't even know if the app still exists, but guess what? Now it's a website.
Indeed. And so you can go to iCare-calculator.vercel.app and you can try it out.
Yeah. And this is, I feel like this is something that Apple's, you know, interface to Apple Care One should be telling you, just like it does when it initially gives you the come on, hey, join Apple Care One and you'll save X number of dollars per month. That calculator should always be active. So when you add devices, it should be telling you, don't add that, you'll be paying $2 more a month. Or do add that, you'll be saving this much more a month. But it doesn't, so that leaves room for this app. So check it out. We'll put the link in the notes. I've been battling with Apple Care One. I mentioned last time that I had added my son's MacBook Air and it showed me some orange text that it was going to be removed soon. And I had to, like, sign into it with my Apple ID because everything in Apple Care One has to be on the same Apple ID. So I made an account on my son's Mac and signed into it, and the orange text went away. And then I got an email that said it had been removed, and just, it was this battle, right? And every time it gets added, it, like, cancels the previous one and gives me a refund and gets embedded back or whatever. Anyway, a couple things in this. One, people were asking me about this on Mastodon, and I realized, even though Apple's own documentation, which we read last episode, said all the devices on Apple Care One have to be on the same Apple ID, it prompted me with its initial come on to say, you should add John's iPhone 16 Pro, Tina's iPhone 15 Pro, and, you know, one of the Macs in the house or whatever. My wife's phone doesn't have my Apple ID on it, because someone asked, do you share an Apple ID with your wife? I said, no, she's got her own. I've never signed into my Apple ID on any of her phones. They're her phones. And yet it prompted me that that's one of the three devices that should be part of the $19 a month or whatever. So currently, my Apple Care One plan has my phone, my wife's phone, and a Mac on it. Or no, and my iPad, I think, as part of the three that you get for $19.99 or whatever. So I don't know what explains that. Maybe in the initial Apple Care One thing, it doesn't care what Apple ID things are on. But every time I try to add my son's MacBook Air, it lets me add it, and then sends me an obnoxious email a day later that says, your Apple Care One add-on has been canceled per your request. Oh no, I'm sorry, it's not per my request. You just did it yourself. And I keep getting these emails, per your request, we've canceled your Apple Care One and issued you a refund for $3.86. And it's like, and then what do I see when I go into the settings general Apple Care on my phone? I see Alex's MacBook Air, coverage expired, and then orange text that says, eligible to add to Apple Care plan. Is it eligible? Because it seems like it's not. It will let me add it. And then 2 days later, it will say your Apple Care One has been canceled per your request. And so I've given up. I cannot add my son's MacBook Air because every time I add it, 2 days go by, and then I get an obnoxious email telling me it's been removed per my request. And then my wife yells at me because our credit card bill is like, you know, -$599, +$386, -$599, +$4.24. Like, it seems broken to me. So I don't know what the deal is, everybody. It seems like the come on that tells you how much you could save is real, and adding your own devices should work fine. But if you're trying to add a Mac that happens to have an account with your Apple ID on it, apparently they'll let you do it and entice you to do it and ask. I'm being prompted everywhere. Add Alex's MacBook Air. And it will let me add it, but then it rejects it. So I'm a little bit soured on AppleCare One, but now I'm kind of committed to it.
Cool. All right. With regard to buying new Macs, Bruce Steinberg writes, one amazing thing about B&H Photo Video is that they stock built-to-order Macs available for express shipping overnight in the New York City region, often at a discount. Even better, they sell off their inventory of last generation Macs at sometimes enormous discounts. Several years back, I got a MacBook Pro M1 Max with maxed out RAM for 50% off. Not a refurb, brand new shortly after the M2 MacBook Pros had come out. You can also add AppleCare Plus directly to your order, and they have all the build-to-order options for the current generation Macs. There's really no reason to choose to buy from Apple rather than B&H, especially because they provide a 30-day return window rather than 14 days, aside from the Mac Pro, which they only sell via special order for obvious reasons. So I took a look at this, and this is mostly true. Like, I went to see if I could find my Mac, or the M4 equivalent of my Mac, because I have an M3, in mine was a build to order and blah, blah, blah. And I tried to find it and I couldn't find an exact equivalent, but I got surprisingly close. And this is an 8 terabyte hard drive. This is 64 gigs of RAM. Like, this is not a terribly commonly built computer, I don't think. And it got really, really close. So I was surprised.
Yeah. The key to this one is you have to wait until the new ones have just been released and buy one of the old ones, which is not what tech nerds want to do. They want the latest and greatest, but you can get good deals, and these are not like refurb. It's just them clearing inventory in the old-fashioned sense, so it's a thing to watch out for. Sometimes you can get super good deals.
Just to be clear, what I'm talking about was I tried to find an M4, a brand new equivalent of my current computer, just to see, you know, what build to order style options do they have. And the point I'm trying to make, and maybe I failed, was that they do have a surprising amount, as Bruce said, of build to order like options where you can get a lot more than you would expect, you know, a lot more different combinations than you would expect. And certainly more than what an Apple store would carry.
I guess they just buy the inventory. And like guess at what people will want, and then that's why they end up being on sales, because they have to guess what configurations are going to sell, and then eventually they've just got them hanging around and the new computers are coming out and they just got to get rid of these old configs that didn't sell.
All right, let's talk about retro computing on the web. This is, I presume, a carry-on from Overtime last week, where we spoke about that really cool website where you can use all the different versions of macOS and look at preferences and settings and whatnot. Tell me about eWorld, John. What the heck is eWorld?
eWorld was, remember AOL? Remember AOL interface? I believe the company, I don't know the historical details of this, but I believe the company that made that AOL interface, at least on the Mac, sort of like white labeled that thing where they would make an online service like that for anybody and you just supply like the artwork. So Apple essentially made their own AOL type thing called eWorld based on the same software as the AOL client for the Mac, I believe, at the time. And it was a silly online thing in the sort of pre-widespread internet days. Anyway, this is an archive.org web link to a website that is no longer online that tries to reproduce the experience of using eWorld, similar to the like control panel thing we talked about in Overtime last time, that has like it shows you the computer, right, with like the monitor and everything, and then it runs the CRT has little scan lines on it and everything, and then it runs it. But this is not emulation. This is not running the original Mac software. This is like a reproduction using, I don't know, does it use Flash? Does it use, I don't even know what it uses, but it's not the real software. One of the fun things about it not using the real software is that it can do things that actual emulation has some difficulty with. So, for example, making the modem screeching noise when you connect. Like, that's not part of the modem noise comes from a hardware device that's connected to your Mac. So if you emulate macOS, you're not getting that noise. But in this little thing, they'll give you that noise, right? The reason I know it's not emulation, though, is because it's very convincing. They do a really good job. Like, I recognize a lot of the software it's running, is because of one of the things that we discussed when talking about the control panel thing from Overtime. the way the menus work. Whoever wrote this forgot to implement the thing where if you click on the file menu and hold down the mouse cursor and then move the hold down the mouse button and then move the cursor down and release, that it should select a menu item. They just forgot that that's how one of the ways that you could use Mac menus, so that doesn't work at all. And so I'm like, okay, this isn't running Mac OS. This is a clever web-based simulation of Mac OS. And I thought that was interesting to see, because that's one of the beauties of like actually running the real Mac OS software through 15 layers of, you know, JavaScript and WebAssembly or whatever they need to do, is because you get the real behaviors. When you try to simulate it, you're relying on the person who's creating the faked interface to know how everything worked. And this person obviously just assumed, well, of course you click on the menu and then you release the button and then you go into the item you want and you click on it again. That's how menus work. They work another way too. At least, first of all, they work that way now. So they should have known if they're using a Mac now that you can do it that way. But second of all, they definitely work that way back in classic Mac OS days. So I thought that was funny. I also think it's cool that this website works on archive.org, because so many things with just images in them break on archive.org. So if you want to see eWorld, or a weird simulation of eWorld, check it out. Link will be in the notes.
All right, let's talk about Tahoe and the new beta and so on. Apparently, a friend of the show, Gus Mueller, wrote, and we have a screen capture of this. I honestly thought that the checkbox button was missing in this macOS Tahoe screenshot. And there's a screenshot, write folder, and trash. The folder trash is currently in the trash. Then there's a message, do not show this message again. Okay. And I looked at this after having read his message about the checkbox for a solid 60 seconds before I found where the checkbox was. It's to the left of the words, do not show this message again. I could not find it. I am not making this up. I genuinely was deeply confused for a really too long amount of time.
Yeah, so this is not beta 5. This was, I believe, beta 4. And it's relevant because just like the day or two before I saw this post, I was talking to someone about the disaster that is the Tahoe interface. And I said, have you seen what unchecked checkboxes look like? That was the specific example I chose because I couldn't believe it. Anyway, apparently people are discovering what unchecked checkboxes look like in Tahoe. And on the background of a dialogue, they're basically invisible. I didn't look at the RGB values for this, but I encourage you to look at his toot, see the original image as posted to Mastodon, and see for yourself if you can see the checkbox. And if you think that's what an unchecked checkbox should look like in any circumstance.
It isn't what it should look like ever.
And I believe it is not a disabled checkbox. This is an enabled, actively clickable unchecked checkbox.
Yeah, it's real bad.
You know, like, you know, when the rumors were that there was going to be a big redesign of all the systems, I believe one of our concerns was that, you know, the Mac seems like it hasn't gotten a lot of attention recently in design, and that when it does get attention, it seems like it is the last priority. It seems like its design kind of has like the least effort put into it, and problems take a long time to get solved. I think that's panning out. Like, this new design, all the liquid glass era stuff, like, it's on the Mac. It seems like it makes the least sense on the Mac, and there has been the least testing. And this is the kind of thing, you know, like what we saw last time with the disk image selector, which I guess we're about to talk about. But this is one of the things, like, we're going to have a lot of this kind of stuff on the Mac, of just, like, ways in which the new design just falls down, not because it can't be good, but just because, like, stuff was changed and it wasn't tested enough or it wasn't considered enough on the Mac. And that's the reality of them doing a redesign these days. So it just kind of goes along with the territory.
Someone in the chat room tried to pull up the RGB values from, I'm assuming, from Gus's Mastodon post. And it's RGB 237 versus RGB 239. So a difference of two. They could get it, they could get it better if they just did 238 to 239. All right. Anyway, one more thing from Gus Mueller. He had another toot. He says, trick question. Is this Tahoe slider enabled or disabled? The answer is either. It draws exactly the same either way.
Neat.
So I found this as well when messing with my Mac apps, that a lot of the times controls that are enabled look like they're disabled. And then apparently in the case of this slider, the enabled and disabled state are exactly the same.
That's wonderful.
I mean, that seems like a fundamental problem.
Like I've been, you know, adopting the new design for Overcast and just going through different screens and figuring out, you know, how to do certain controls and everything. And one of the challenges I'm having with the new design in adoption is there's a lot of, you know, controls or design consideration where I'm just like, I don't think I can make this look good. Like with the current design language. And so I'm left with like, okay, do I, you know, buck the design language and go my own way, which has a lot of downsides and a lot of costs and I think is risky. Or do I adopt the design language and make something that I think is a little bit hard to see or hard to distinguish or hard to use? And that has its own set of trade-offs. It's just, this has been a very difficult design language to adopt. You know, as soon as your app does not look exactly like Apple's pretty screenshots, and even when it does sometimes, it's very hard to work with this design language effectively. And, you know, certainly by us running into this as we try to adopt our apps to use it, certainly Apple's internal developers for Apple's apps have probably had similar challenges. Like, it's a really hard language to use, and in a way that is, you know, usable and clear and versatile across lots of different content. And so, again, you know, I mean, I don't know who uses computers more, Alan Dye or Tim Cook, but it's hard to see, like, how do they get out of this? Like, I'm not asking them to throw away the whole design, but there's a lot of parts of it that need, I think, substantially more tweaks than what we are likely to see in the next handful of weeks before release. So this is what's going to ship, basically. And we're going to have a lot of stuff you can't see on the Mac, and we'll have to deal with it.
Well, good news on the tweaking front. Now getting to Tahoe Beta 5, which was released today, I believe. They did, quote-unquote, fix the startup disk thing. And by fix, I mean they changed it to be the same amount of contrast it had in Sequoia, which, as I said in the last episode when we talked about this, it was already bad in Sequoia. So changing it back to be what it was like in Sequoia is not really fixing it, but at least it's doing no harm. So previously in beta 4, it was like a 1.5% difference in dark and RGB values between the gray of the background and the gray of the selection. Now it's back up to 3.1, which is double what it was in beta 4, which is pretty much exactly what it was in Sequoia. So I don't know if that was on purpose or by accident, probably by accident, because that seems how a lot of things happen here. But yeah, they should really be cranking up the contrast dial on a lot of things in Tahoe, and at least this one little corner of the U.S., is no longer getting worse in beta 5, but who knows what beta 6 will bring. Oh, and they changed the hard drive icons to be the hideous things where there's no vanishing point, but there was a surprisingly large dust up about that across the entire little community, including multiple web. I think even The Verge ran a story on it over the hard drive icon. Anyway, it is hideous. It is bad. It doesn't look good. It's dumb.
It's really bad.
Like so much in liquid glass, but in the end, it's just a hard drive icon, so it's whatever.
But it's like the perspective is so comically wrong. Like when you see it, it kind of breaks your brain a little bit, and it makes you wonder, like, how did this get into a, like, how did this get out of Apple? How did this get out of like the designer's desk who made it? Like, it's really weird. Like the perspective is so comically wrong.
Did you see the thing that I retweeted of someone who 3D modeled it in Blender to show how it would work?
Like an
and
L-shaped.
He made it L-shaped. So when you you make it L-shaped, so when you turn it head-on, the L-shaped one looks exactly like Apple's one. Because it doesn't make any sense from it has no vanishing point, and you can see the top of it completely, but also the front of it. And it's just, it's bad. Whatever. Like, hopefully they will tweak these icons in next year's release and... we'll get some kind of improvement. I'm mostly upset that they don't look appealing to me. Like I don't think they look good, especially for things like hard drive icons. It's like it doesn't really have much of, you know, it could have been a place for them to try to come up with it. It's a difficult problem, right? Because hard drives are no longer physical drives inside our computers. They're like chips that are soldered onto our motherboards, or, you know, like they're, it's hard to think of how I'd represent them with an icon. So it's a fun problem. And Apple's like, no, we're not dealing with that problem. We're just going to show, for the internal drive, we're going to show an abstracted version of what external drives look like in the past decade in an incorrect perspective in an unappealing art style. So good job.
I understand. I mean, granted, you know, this got to hit home with you with the hyperspace icon. But like, I understand that they wanted to get away from the old hard drive icon because it looked like a hard drive, and no modern Macs really have hard drives.
A spinning hard drive, you mean?
Yes. a hard drive. Yeah. So I understand wanting to get away from that and wanting to freshen up the icon, but don't do it if you're going to do this. Like if you're going to freshen it up, do a good job. Like if no one is forcing, they haven't sold hard drives on Macs for a long time. This didn't have to happen right now. Like no one's forcing you to do this icon today. Go back, take a few days, do a better one. It'll be fine. You have plenty of time.
Yeah, when I came up with the design idea for the hyperspace icon, I was talking with the artist at Icon Factory who was doing it. We discussed this very point. Are we sure you want to do a spinning disk? And I was like, no, it should definitely be a spinning disk. Like, I'm not saying that people have spinning disks or that you should use my app with spinning disks, but it looks better in the icon for it to be a spinning disk. And anyone who's going to buy my app is probably old enough to remember spinning disks. And I was like, it's going to, you know, and so to be clear, I'm not changing my icon. It's going to be a spinning disk forever. Think of it as a retro thing.
All right. Justin Bradford writes, with regard to ejecting USB storage on Windows, in version 1809 of Windows 10, which was around 2019, Microsoft changed the default behavior of USB storage devices to disable cache writes to allow removal of a drive basically anytime the drive appears idle. There's an option for the old method, but then it is recommended that you click the dialog that Marco was talking about to write the cache and then eject the drive. I have to imagine this was the result of many, many users corrupting a thumb drive by removing it while a write was active. Here's a link with more info, which we'll put in the show notes. The default removal policy for external storage media was changed by Microsoft in Windows 10 version 1809 from better performance to quick removal, which for some users may translate to faster removal times with degraded performance.
Quick removal. Yeah, we'll just make it be slow all the time to give you the ability to yank it out whenever you feel like it, because you can't be trusted to unmount things. This is why you can't have nice things.
Mm-hmm. Then finally, we have a couple topics with regard to the art and science of user interface design. Anonymous writes, Syracuse is probably almost right in that the science is lost in UI design. It's not lost in the games industry. I work at a very large games company. We employ UX researchers, and all aspects of our games are tested on regular people. Their reactions to the menus, game mechanics, etc. are recorded and studied.
This is an interesting case here, because what's different about the games industry than the computer industry today? The difference is, the games industry is fiercely competitive, especially if you are making a game and you're not one of the platform. Like this, you know, there's not too many platform owners, but lots of companies make games. If you make a game, there's not much barrier for someone deciding not to play or not to buy or not to subscribe to or whatever your game and to go to somebody else's game, because there's not a lot of game lock-in. So you have to, like, there's competition. I'm saying people want to make games that people enjoy playing. And so, in a competitive environment, yeah, you better believe they employ UX researchers to figure out, can people figure out how to play our game? Do they get frustrated? Is it easy to use? Like, all these user interface things. And the games industry wants those people because it contributes to their bottom line. In what situation would that not contribute to the bottom line? What if there's massive platform lock-in, like on Windows or Mac or iOS or Android or whatever, where there's not a lot of platforms to choose from, and then once you commit to one, it's a monetary investment, it's an investment of skills and learning how the ecosystem works, buying apps for it, all that other stuff. It just shows how uncompetitive our technology market, personal computers and phones and iPads, all that stuff, is compared to another technology-based market of games, where there are tons of game companies and tons of games fighting tooth and nail to get those consumers to play their game and not somebody else's. And I think that's my explanation for why it's so important for them and not important, because just look what's happening with Liquid Glass, which I will continue to call Liquid Metal accidentally. Yeah, they're shipping it. People are grumpy about it. But people are like, what are you going to do? Switch to Android? It takes so much to, there's so much platform lock-in that, like, Apple could be like, if we ship an interface that people don't really like, or ship a version of Photos that people complain about, or if we mess up the phone for a little bit or whatever, we can probably weather that storm, because we'd have to really, really mess up for people to give up all the apps they bought and all the things they bought on all services and all the skills and experience they have with our platform for them to leave us, versus, like, you come out with a cruddy version of Call of Duty and people go play a different FPS. And that happens all the time, and people aren't, you know, abandoning platforms as much. So I think this is the lack of scientific rigor in user experience design at Apple and other major platforms is further evidence of the lack of competition.
And then with regard to game design concepts and software, Wes Davis writes, when you guys talked about using game design approaches for software, John talked about the coyote time approach of letting a player jump moments after leaving a ledge. For years, I've thought about exactly that concept every time an iOS notification pops in right as I'm about to tap a control at the top of the screen and hijacks what I was trying to do. Please, Apple, give me a coyote time for banner notifications. Coyote notification time? Eh? That name is ridiculous, but, and I know it was said in jest, but this happens to me freaking constantly.
So this is a tricky problem. The reason I put this in here is because it's not as simple as the coyote time for like ledge jumping and stuff like that. There's no like, oh, they should obviously do this and it will fix it. Because the problem is you see the screen, you have a thought, and then it takes some time for that thought to translate into motion in your fingers touching the thing that's on the screen. And between the time you decide to tap that button and the signal goes down your arm and to your finger and you're going to tap, like there's between that, when that happens, a notification appears and it turns out your finger hits the screen just as the notification appears. You could kind of coyote time that to say, okay, notifications aren't tappable for the first N milliseconds, but then if you're really quick on the draw and you know a notification is coming and it comes up and you tap it and nothing happens, it feels broken.
Yep.
Because you're like, well, I just tapped it, and so how many milliseconds do you set that time to be? So this is one of the things that's really hard to like dial in unless you have a very controlled situation where you know exactly what the person is doing, exactly what their reaction time is, because both ways, like ignoring the allowing the tap to go to the things underneath the notification because that's what you intended to hit because your finger started moving before the notification appeared, it's a really hard problem. A lot of the problems like the coyote time thing and platforming are not that hard. There are sort of known solutions for them and you just have to implement them the right way. But yeah, this happens to me. This happens to everybody. It's tricky. And that's one of the things about interfaces. Like you have to rethink, like say you were trying to make an interface for, I don't want to do the, like the Navy ship that crashed into something because of bad user interface. But if you're trying to do an interface for like, steering a gigantic, boat on the water, maybe don't have things that pop up on the screen over controls that people try to hit. Whereas on the phone, that's the part of the interface is notifications appear and they just cover things that are on the screen. We just accept that because the mishitting a notification is not the same as missteering a boat into another boat. But yeah, that's part of the design of the interfaces. If it's really important for that never to happen, don't pop up new interface elements unbidden on top of other ones.
All right, let's do some topics. A week or two, and actually almost a month ago now, the iPhone 17 Pro's rumored new MagSafe design, reading from Mac Rumors. The leaker Jin Boo today shared a photo of the alleged MagSafe magnet arrays for third-party iPhone 17 Pro cases. On existing iPhone models with MagSafe, the magnets form a complete circle, but the new layout has an opening in it. And there is a link to Mygen's official website, and we will also link the picture of the iPhone 16 Pro with a MagSafe case, where you can see clear as day that there is a circle of MagSafe magnets. The Apple logo is pretty much directly in the center of it. And in the 17 Pro, allegedly, the Apple logo has been moved down, so it's kind of in the way of the bottom of the magnet circle. And so there is no magnet circle.
So here's the thing. If you look at the Mygen Boo things where like the parts that he's got, if you scroll down the page and see like those teal little pieces, you see that?
Mm-hmm.
There's no Apple logo on those. So while I'm willing to believe that this incomplete circle, MagSafe circle, is the design for the back of the phone because these parts leaks seem, it's around that time that we'd be getting these types of leaks, I'm currently wondering, what does that mean for the Apple logo on the back of the phone? Because I don't think they're going to put it where this Mac Rumors mock-up put it.
No,
like that's
terrible.
What they did is the back of the iPhone 17 Pro basically has a full-width camera mesa, and then below it has another rounded rectangle. And they put the Apple logo in the center of the lower rounded rectangle. But the center of the lower rounded rectangle is not the center of the MagSafe circle. It's lower than that. So that's where the mock-up put the Apple logo. I guess you could just move the Apple logo up and put it in the center of the partial circle. Or, what do you think of this? No Apple logo on the back of the iPhone 17 Pro.
No way.
Well, so what's your guess for where will the Apple logo be positioned, or will there be one? Assuming that this MagSafe design is true.
I think it'll be where it is today. There's just going to be less MagSafe stuff beneath it.
Do you think it'll be centered in the partial circle?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, see,
it's interesting. I mean, they chose not to do that because I think one of the other rumors, you'll see, I think there are separate rumor stories that are like, the Apple logo is going to be centered in the rounded rectangle, not where it used to be. I don't know what to think.
I mean, the actual back of the phone, you don't see the MagSafe shape. So this is only an issue when you have like a clear case or an Apple-designed case that, you know, for some reason still has the Apple logo visible, you know, on the outside of the case. But also you can see the MagSafe for some reason. But so it's basically only the problem with the clear case. This kind of thing, I can see Apple just maybe like discontinuing the clear case if that's going to be the problem. But like,
That's fair.
I think ultimately the Apple logo, I think, will remain in the middle of the circle, not in the middle of the flat area. Because with the Apple logo in the middle of the flat area of the back of the phone, it puts it pretty far below the like overall center of the phone, and I think it kind of just makes it look droopy. Like, you don't want the Apple logo to look like it's, you know, beneath something. Obviously Tim Cook is beneath a lot of dignity right now, but you don't want the Apple logo.
Couldn't help yourself.
No, of course not. But you don't want the Apple logo to be down on the shape of the phone. You want it to be like prominent, center or up. Like, you don't want it to be on the lower half, and that's what this is depicting. I can't see Apple doing that.
Yeah, I think they're still going to have the clear case. I think the Apple logo does actually look better centered in the rectangular part, just because if it is styled as they're showing here, where it's like two-tone, like it's a different color than the rest of it, so you can clearly see it. But I'm thinking back to, do you remember the case, the Apple case with a bunch of holes in it? I think it was on the 5C phones.
Yeah, it was on the 5C.
Remember how badly those holes lined up with like the Apple logo or whatever that was on the back of the phone? And people, it looked very un-Apple-like. I think they're willing to have awkward alignment between the phone body and the case, but we'll see. This is one of the more interesting rumors, this, because these phones have been so thoroughly leaked with like down to the fraction of a millimeter models of every single phone in the lineup of being out for months now, that this is one thing there seems to be disagreement on is where the Apple logo will go, because the mock-ups for case designs don't actually include that information, because it's not important when you're designing a case, because the Apple logo is not, it's not indented, it's not poking out, it's just a part of the flat surface. So keep an eye out for where will the Apple logo be, or will there be one? I agree there will probably still be one.
All right, Apple's new Answers team eyes ChatGPT-like product and AI push, writes Mark Gurman. Apple has a new Answers team developing a stripped-down rival to ChatGPT to help users access world knowledge. Earlier this year, Apple formed a new team called Answers Knowledge and Information, or AKI. This group, I'm told, is exploring a number of in-house AI services with the goal of creating a new ChatGPT-like search experience. The AKI team is led by our former friend, Robbie Walker, a senior director reporting to AI chief John Gianandrea. Walker previously oversaw Siri, but lost control of it after engineering delays. Following that shakeup, he was assigned to the new Answers initiative and has brought along several key team members from his Siri days. While still in early stages, the team is building what it calls an answer engine, a system capable of crawling the web to respond to general knowledge questions. A standalone app is currently under exploration alongside new backend infrastructure meant to power search capabilities in future versions of Siri Spotlight and Safari. Apple's recently begun advertising job openings for the team on its career site. Several listings specifically mention experience with search algorithms and engine development.
So I can't tell from this rumor whether the answer engine thing is a search engine or is an LLM or both, because this is described as a ChatGPT-like search experience. When I think of an answers team, I mean, I guess it depends on what they're being asked to answer, but like, I think there's still a place in Apple's software stack for something that can answer questions from like a knowledge base. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Not make up statistically likely answers from a knowledge base that it was trained on, but like literally look stuff up. Kind of like what, you know, Gruber is going on about when the whole thing about like who won the Super Bowls. You can just put all the Super Bowl winners and the scores and the info in like a structured database and have a thing that knows how to pull that info out. And it won't be wrong because it knows, as long as it correctly interprets which Super Bowl you're talking about, it can look it up in the structured database and just give you the answer that it has in its database. And I guess the info in the database could be wrong, but you know, once you get the database right, there's not a lot of variability. It will give you the scores, it will give you the teams, it will give you the years, it will give you whatever is in the database. That's not an LLM. The LLM may parse your question, but this could be a tool that the LLM uses to say, hey, if anyone asks you about the Super Bowl, if you interpret whatever mumbo-jumbo they told you that they're asking about the Super Bowl, LLM thing, use this tool, and then the tool would be the answer engine that goes and looks up all the state capitals, the populations of various countries, you know, like facts, to have a fact, right? And I think there's a place for that. Siri used to do that. Like, that was basically how Siri worked. If you asked it sort of quote-unquote world knowledge questions, it either had some kind of database with the structured information that it could give you, or it didn't, and it'd be like, I couldn't tell you that. But in the age of LLMs with quote-unquote world knowledge, they'll make up anything. You can ask them anything, and they'll tell you something, all right? And that's why people are trying to make LLMs to be essentially like tool-using devices, where their job is to interpret what the request is and to figure out which tool to use, and then those tools are not probabilistic word generator things, but are instead specific tools that do a particular task, like look up some data in a database or whatever. I hope that's what they're making, because one of the things that I feel like is a frustration with LLM type stuff is we expect, from our experience in the past with computers, we expect computers to be good at the things that humans are not good at. So computers can do math really, really fast. Humans can't. And computers get the answers right all the time, unless it's a hardware failure. Humans don't. But with LLMs, that all changes. All the things that we expect them to be good at, of like their speed and infallibility, don't exist anymore. And it's sometimes tricky to find out how to get value out of a thing like that. Like, we want them to be like, well, the computer says it must be right. I asked it about the Super Bowl, and it understood my question, and it told me this team won, and this was the score. But it turns out that's just statistically probable nonsense, and it's wrong, right? Having a plain old boring set of structured data retrieval tools, like an answer engine, that can be used by an LLM to look stuff up once it understands what the user wants, seems like a really great idea for me. And I really hope that's what they're doing. But then seeing the names associated with this, like Robbie Walker, who got all that bad press about the Siri stuff, also seems kind of like, well, we kicked all these people off Siri, so they need something to do, so give them this other thing. And it doesn't make me feel like it is a high priority project.
I mean, we'll see what happens with all their AI efforts and projects. Like, it's obviously finally in a state of significant flux. That's good. We know that's where we wanted them to be, because they, you know, I think we can agree they were heading in some bad directions before, or simply not heading
nowhere.
Directions. Right. Yeah. Exactly. There's going to be a lot of, you know, fits and starts and big attempts, small attempts. I think this is great. You know, at least they are trying things now that seem like they are both, you know, achievable and important to their customers. You know, if they were going to have some big moonshot projects, I'd rather than try to build a world knowledge AI than a car or a VR headset, honestly. So I think this is good news. Like, even if it never becomes anything, or even if they try it and it sucks, like, I'd rather they try this kind of stuff than not.
I can't tell if you're saying moonshot as a humorous reference to your past saying of that word, or if you've just forgotten that it's moonshot.
I forgot. Right. Now yeah. I remember. So,
like, here's the thing. Do you remember when whatever they announced, it might have been a WWDC, the Apple Intelligence one, they're like, and we've fed it Siri knowledge about our products, and now you can ask it about our products, and then people tried it, and it would just tell you to go to settings that don't exist in settings and stuff like that. Like, the value of features like that essentially goes to zero if you can't rely on it giving you answers. And it's kind of embarrassing for, like, Apple's own products, that, like, if they're advertising the fact that you can ask your phone how to, like, you know, how do I turn on dark mode, and it tells you go to settings, go here, go this, go that. Like, if it's wrong, you're like, you're the phone. The one thing you should know about is where the stuff is in you. And once you get a wrong answer once or twice from that, you're going to stop asking it, because it seems like it's just wasting your time. This is where an answer engine could come in handy. I feel like you could structure that data in some way that it would always give you an answer that is relevant to whatever operating system your phone is running, whatever, you know, like, it should know this, right? This is a knowable, tractable thing. It's just so much more work to do it that way than to just feed all the knowledge base articles and documentation to an LLM and then cross your fingers, which is what everyone wants to do. They're just like, well, just throw all the stuff at it and then put it in front of customers. And it's right most of the time, so that's good, right? And I'm like, eh, yeah. So my fingers are really crossed about this knowledge engine thing, because I want this to be a deterministic tool that is used by the LLMs, and I don't want it to be, we just fed a bunch of documentation to a different LLM so it can give you a different set of maybe right answers.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that I think this is definitely something that they should be exploring. I also agree that if the reporting about Robbie Walker in particular, and Gian Andrea actually, is anywhere near true, and they are not as great as maybe they should be to be put in these positions, I don't know, that scares me a little bit. And it's certainly like a, well, we don't want to fire you, but just go over here and play for a little while, like a toddler, right? Like, distract.
It doesn't seem like it's the A team. On this,
right,
maybe.
Exactly. Which, I mean, maybe we're darn wrong. Maybe Robbie Walker and John Gian Andrea were completely.
I mean, all we know is that they didn't produce results. We don't know why, but like, we do know that they had a job and they didn't do it.
Exactly.
Well, we'll see.
I mean, I'm really hopeful that this will turn out to be something fruitful. I don't even really care if it's an LLM or not, as long as it works. But yeah, we'll see. Hello, Future Marco. We are still fairly early, but we can either ask ATP at this point, or we can do this roadmap. I concur with our earlier theory that it won't take too long, but do we want to plow forward?
It's been a while since we've done Ask ATP. I think we should probably do that this episode.
John?
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, the timeline will keep, because it's years in the future, so it's not like it's going to catch up to that.
All right. And selfishly, I wouldn't mind a not terribly long episode. So let's move to Ask ATP. Goodbye, Future Marco.
Bye.
All right, let's do some Ask ATP, where Steve writes, I have a desktop laptop, MacBook Air. It has an external SSD permanently attached, which I use for Time Machine backups. Whenever the MacBook wakes from sleep, it pings a notification, disk not ejected properly. Eject M1 Time Machine before disconnecting it or turning it off. Can I stop this from happening without having to dismount and remount the drive every time I walk away from the computer? It's annoying and worrying that I might be corrupting my backups. Before John starts fussing about desktop laptops, we know that desktops would solve this problem, but you can't move a desktop, John. That's the other problem.
I don't know if desktops would solve this problem, because the problem is, like, going to sleep and waking from sleep. Desktops also go to sleep and wake from sleep.
That's fair. All right. See, I was trying to get ahead of all the complaining and moaning about laptops, but it turns out you're not complaining and moaning.
What I'm saying is, are you worried you might be corrupting your backups? Yeah, you should be worried. If it says disk not ejected properly, that's not an annoyance that you should live with. That's an indication that something is going wrong. And we've talked about this in past episodes. What's going wrong? Was it whatever chipset is running the interface on your external drive mechanism? Is it some driver issue with your version? Whatever it is, it's a problem, and you should do something about it, because you can't allow this to stand. Anyway, one of the workarounds, believe it or not, there is an app for this from St. Clair Software. What else do they make? They make Keyboard Maestro and a bunch of other stuff. Anyway, it's called Jettison. The tagline is, manually take control of your external disks directly from your menu bar. Automatically eject disks before your Mac sleeps or after your display powers off. With Jettison, just close your MacBook, unplug, and go. This is working around this apparently issue that is common with external disks with macOS by saying, install this software and, like, you don't have to remember to manually unmount your things when you put your thing to sleep. We will automatically unmount them before your MacBook goes to sleep, and maybe remount them or whatever. But, like, what you're trying, this is an unfortunate workaround for a disk that keeps remounting itself. Really, your disk should not be unmounting itself when your Mac goes to sleep. As someone who has had many, many external drives connected to many, many Macs, you should be able to put it to sleep and wake it up, and you should see no messages about volumes unmounting. You shouldn't. It's not happened, but, you know, we don't live in a perfect world, so check out Jettison.
All right. Jeff writes, I started working with Xcode in January, and something has been bothering me, specifically as it pertains to the amount of space that Xcode uses on your hard drive. I have an M4 Mac Mini with 24 gigs of memory and a 512 gig SSD, and the last couple of weeks I've been using Xcode a lot, and I noticed that my storage available space dropped from close to 400 gigs to under 240 gigs over that time. I figured it had to be Xcode, because in system settings, developer was taking up around 50 gigs. So I tried putting Xcode onto an external SSD. I already stored my projects there. It seemed to make no difference. So I moved it back to my internal hard drive. I was about to pull the trigger on a $2,000 Mac Mini with 48 gigs of memory and 2 terabytes of storage when this morning I checked my storage and 100 gigs had suddenly rematerialized. Can you explain this or give me some insight on how the storage relating to Xcode works? John, tell me about file systems, if you please.
Yeah, so free space in macOS is tricky because of the fancy features of the Apple file system. It's just a fact of life. You can't have these fancy features without some confusion about free space. There is no obvious thing that Apple should do that would make it clear to everybody all the time. There just isn't. So that's an unfortunate complexity of modern computing life. The workaround is just buy so much storage you never need to worry about it, but that's very expensive, especially in Apple world. So one of the things that could be making your hogging your space and then having your space suddenly reappear are local Time Machine backups. If you are running Time Machine, and it's not clear if Jeff is, but if you're running Time Machine, Time Machine does this thing where it makes local snapshots, where it takes a point in time snapshot of your entire volume periodically, sometimes several of them. And those snapshots keep data alive even if it's subsequently deleted. Because as long as data is referenced by any existing snapshots, it can't be actually freed up. So if you take a snapshot, or Time Machine takes a snapshot behind the scenes without you knowing, and again, this has nothing to do with like an external Time Machine disk. I'm saying if you're running Time Machine and like you unplug the Time Machine disk, doesn't matter. These are local snapshots on the volume that is going to be backed up. It makes these snapshots because that's what it can back up from. It takes a snapshot and then you delete 200 gigs worth of stuff. You're not getting that space back until the snapshot that references those 200 gigs also goes away. Time Machine will delete these local snapshots periodically. It doesn't make them forever. So they sort of go off the end. I don't know how many it keeps. I don't know how long it keeps. The policy always changes or whatever. But like within a few days or hours or whatever, the snapshot that referenced those 200 gigs of files that you deleted, that snapshot will be deleted or discarded. And now nothing references that 200 gigs worth of data. And then you get it back as free space. You can see the complexity of the Finder trying to show what your free space is. Does it, when you delete those 200 gigs, don't you want to see the number go up by 200 gigs? But what if it didn't really delete it? What if it's still referenced in a snapshot? Should it lie to you and tell you that's free space? Sometimes it does, because in theory, there's this system in macOS that considers that space quote-unquote purgeable. So if it needs space and it doesn't have enough, it can say, what can I purge? And one of the things it can purge is your Time Machine snapshot. So it might show you that you have that 200 gigs free, knowing that if any app tries to use that space, macOS would be like, oh, actually, that space isn't free, but I can make it free. Just hang on a second. I'll just delete the snapshot. And that's time-consuming. It's tricky. And the big complaint about macOS is it doesn't purge the purgeable space fast enough or in a timely enough manner. So even though there's supposedly space available, it doesn't become available fast enough. Anyway, we'll put a link, a couple links in the show notes explaining what Time Machine local snapshots are and how you can view them. You used to be able to, used to have to use a command line tool to do this, but now plain old disk utility will show you your Time Machine snapshots and will let your local Time Machine snapshots and will let you delete them with a little minus button in disk utility. So no longer do you have to do command line hacking. I have found, in my experience, I often have to manually delete local Time Machine snapshots to free up space in a timely manner because macOS is just too slow and too reticent to purge that purgeable space. So that's one thing. The other thing is Xcode taking up space. Xcode does take up tons of space in places that people might not realize, so much so that there is a pretty good app dedicated to this called Dev Cleaner that I've been running for a long time. Do you guys run Dev Cleaner?
Yes, no. I do.
There you go. Casey, you found an app for you. So it runs periodically. Even if you forget to run it, it will periodically pop up a notification and say, hey, you haven't run this in a while. You should probably run it now. And it shows you all the space being taken up for Xcode stuff that you can safely delete. Now, safely is, you know, one of the things it will show you is how much space is being taken up with archive builds of your app. You probably don't want to delete those. At least I don't. Maybe I'm just hoarding them or they're good for debugging or whatever. But like, it will show you those. So don't think you can just delete everything. You have to have some knowledge to use this tool. It will show you things like SDKs that you've downloaded that you're not using anymore. Oh, I'm not doing iPad development anymore. And in fact, there's two different iPad SDKs downloaded. I can delete those. You can delete those because if you ever need them again, Xcode will re-download them for you, or you can re-download them from Xcode. It'll show you locally cached documentation. It will show you everyone's favorite derived data. It will show you all sorts of other stuff. It will show you and the sizes, and you can decide which one of these things do you want to delete. And I always forget about it until a notification appears and says, hey, you haven't run Dev Cleaner in a while. Do you want to run it? And that will find some stuff that you can delete. Now, I don't think it explains Jeff's situation where hundreds of gigs are disappearing. It shouldn't be that big, but it does let you get a handle on Xcode and the space that it's using. I would also check if you have like multiple versions of Xcode, or like if you have the .zip file sitting in your download folder. And you know, this gets into just general like using something like Grand Perspective or Daisy Disk or whatever to find what's using space on your disk. But for Xcode in particular, there's an app for that. It's called Dev Cleaner. Check it out.
Yeah, and if you are on the Xcode beta train, or just if you use Xcode for long enough to have multiple versions of Xcode, or have you know, gone through multiple versions of iOS or whatever the platforms are. When Xcode like downloads the iOS runtime files or the watchOS runtime files or all those, you know, when downloading those components after you install the actual app, it doesn't delete the old ones. So if you're like on the beta train, like this summer, we're on the beta train, we're on beta 5. I've downloaded all 5 betas on both of my laptops, and you know, at some point, and so each one of those, like every time you download the new beta, it downloads the like the iOS support files for that version of the beta, which are like 7 gigs, and the you know the watchOS is another 3 gigs, and when you get the new beta, those old files stick around. They're no longer used if you replace, you know, beta 4 of Xcode with beta 5 of Xcode or whatever. But those stick around. Recently, those have moved to a system folder that tools like DevCleaner can't clean. But Xcode itself, if you go into the Xcode settings, there's a tab called Components. And if you scroll down to the bottom, it will show you all the old versions of those components of basically like, you know, old iOS built and stuff that you probably can delete support for because you probably don't need them anymore because the version of Xcode you're running, you usually can't even use them if you wanted to. Or if it's for, you know, some ancient version of Xcode, do you really need separate support files for iOS 18.4 and 18.1 and 18.0? Like, probably not. And you can always re-download that kind of stuff if you need it. So go into the Xcode components menu and you'll be able to delete a lot of stuff from there. And then secondly, if you are running, you know, the iOS simulator, say, on your Mac to test out things on iOS, I run into this problem a lot because my app that I'm testing is Overcast and it downloads files. It downloads podcasts. And so if I like launch a new simulator and I log into an existing test account that already has some podcasts subscribed, it's going to start downloading those files off the internet to my Mac. And it's going to keep those in like a file container for that instance of that simulator. So it could be downloading like a gig or two of MP3s if it's like a big enough account, and those are just sitting in some container folder somewhere. And I'm, you know, I'm testing with them and everything. But then later on, if a new version of Xcode or iOS comes out and I start building my simulator against that, it is a new like copy of the simulator with its own container, and the old one just gets abandoned. And so buried deep inside your library folder somewhere, there's like device support or simulator folders that contain all of the data that has been downloaded by your app running in the simulator in various times. And so, and if you aren't actively going and cleaning those out, those will add up too. So you do have to be fairly diligent with Xcode development for disk space, both Xcode itself in the component menu and in if you're running simulators, like what's going on in those simulators, and are you then abandoning them with gigs of data just sitting there forever? So there's a lot of potential to reclaim disk space by kind of watching Xcode like a hawk, and almost none of it has to do with, as Jeff said, like moving the Xcode app itself to an external disk, because that won't change anything. It's still going to be storing all these other folders on your boot drive, you know, whatever that is. And that being said, I would suggest if you have the ability, no computer from Apple that you intend to use Xcode with should have less than a terabyte of SSD. And even the terabyte, you do have to babysit. Like, that's the terabyte is what I use for my travel laptop. And the reason I know all this stuff about where all these folders are right now is because, like, 2 days ago, it was down to, like, 30 gigs free. I'm like, what? Out of a terabyte? What happened? And sure enough, I had, like, 200 gigs of Xcode waste going on across the computer. It was quite something to find. But even a terabyte, like if I had the 512, I wouldn't fit. Like that would not be enough for all the stuff that I do, even for a travel laptop, because I'm also doing Xcode. Terabyte, if you can, should be your minimum. And I think next time I buy one, I might even go 2 terabytes, just because it's like these things are only growing over time, especially as we getting into like LLMs and downloading models and stuff like that. Like it's only going to keep getting bigger over time.
It's also worth noting that the DevCleaner thing is apparently open source on GitHub as well. So it's on the Mac App Store, but you can also see the source code and try to build it yourself or whatever. So that's nice. And then I've seen a bunch of stories recently about people who are like, my Mac was fine, had plenty of free space, and then overnight I lost 500 gigs. And it turns out to be like, I don't know, Spotlight importer that just got it caught in a loop and was just making tons of little files, or some driver that kept crashing, and every time it crashed, it made like a 4 kilobyte crash log, and it was crashing hundreds of times a second. And there was a directory with literally 6 million files in it. stuff like that can happen with first-party and third-party software. How do you find that? How do you find what's happening? How do these people find what the problem is? We'll put a link in the notes to the app that I use, which is Grand Perspective. What was the other app before Grand Perspective?
There was OmniDisk Sweeper. I always was a big fan of Space Gremlin, and Daisy Disk is the one that everyone else likes.
Yeah, Grand Perspective is a clone of an app that was exactly like Grand Perspective that had a different name. Anyway, Grand Perspective
Yes, I know what you're thinking of, but I can't remember the damn name of it.
Yeah, Grand Perspective gives you a bunch of visual squares. Each square, the area of each rectangle, the area of each rectangle represents the number of bytes. I forget if it's free or cheap, but anyway, it's well worth the money because you can see the big boxes. Like, it takes a long time to do a scan. But just look for where the big rectangle is, or look for where the giant fleets of tiny rectangles are, and you'll very quickly, if there's a directory with 6 million files in it, after you run Grand Perspective and let it run over like 48 hours or however long it takes to do it, you'll see the 6 million files that you didn't expect to be there because they will dwarf everything else. The only advice I will give on Grand Perspective is, in this modern age and in any kind of multi-user type environment, if you have more than one account on your Mac, keep in mind that it cannot see stuff happening in other people's accounts when you run it on your account. So you should go to that other account and run it there as well to get a complete picture, because it can't read those directories. I don't think it runs as root. At least the Mac App Store one doesn't run as root and have admin permissions. But that's how you find those things. I mean, you can do it from the command line. There's a million different ways you can do it. But if you're looking for a GUI app, run this thing, let it run. It will take a long time, and it will show you a graphical representation that you can then hover your mouse cursor over all these little rectangles and show the little info pane. It'll tell you exactly what file you're hovering over or what directory. And then you can reveal that on the Finder and you'll find where the problem is. Fixing the problem might be tricky, especially if it's a Spotlight importer or something, but that's part of the detective work that's required. So, I recommend you do the same, Marco, if you're pushing up against the limits of a 1 terabyte thing and you only found 200 gigs of Xcode waste to delete. So maybe there's something else going wrong.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, also part of it is, there's 200 gigs of photos that were downloaded.
Try to put your photo library on that laptop, too, yeah.
Yeah, and not even with Keep Originals, just, with the automatic storage thing.
Yeah, that's the problem with it. Oh, optimized storage. Sure, we'll use every ounce of free space you have and never purge it when you want space back. Is that what you wanted?
Yeah, remember, back in the day, I used to keep my iCloud photo library file in a disk image that had a quota set on it. I haven't done that in a long time. I wonder if that still would work. Do you know?
I'm surprised it ever worked, but I understand the motivation. But just there should be a setting in Photos that says optimize storage. Underneath that, it should say, and never use more than X amount. And it can put a minimum on it, you have to let me use at least this much because you have this many photos or whatever, but it doesn't. And so it just does whatever it feels like it's doing. By the way, the chat room has told us all that the Grand Perspective predecessor was called Disk Inventory X or 10.
Yes. All right, and then finally tonight, Alan Bailward writes, how do you recommend dealing with spam? For those of us running our own mail server, well, I can stop here. Don't run your own mail server.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
That's a very bad idea.
I'm not trying to be a turd, but I am happy to read the rest of this, but truly, I get the motivation for not wanting to do Gmail or not wanting to do Fastmail, even though I cannot overstate how good my experience with Fastmail has been. I get the motivation. I am super duper into self-hosting these days. I get it, but this is a bad idea. It's just not a good idea to run your own mail server. I cannot stress enough. It's not a good plan. I'm going to read this because I'm not trying to be cruel to Alan, but that is truly my answer, is don't run your own mail server. Alan writes, for those of us running our own mail server or not using Gmail that has a good spam filter, there doesn't seem to be any spam filtering on iOS or iPadOS. The best solution I have is running Spam Sieve on my Mac and leaving mail open all the time. Is there a better way other than switching mail providers? No. If it matters, I'm using OpenSRS for my few domains used by myself and a few friends and family, which costs 50 cents per mailbox per month, a lot better than the $18 Canadian per user per month from G Suite.
I think this question isn't just saying if you run your own mail server, which I agree you should not do it because it's just asking. It's a nightmare, which is a shame, by the way. It should be possible to do it, but the The current situation, the current spam environment makes it pretty much untenable for you to do that. But even if you're not running your own mail server, but you're simply not using a service that has its own decent spam filtering built in, like Gmail tries to have, for example, Apple's mail services, they're doing something related to spam that you have, see if this sounds familiar, no visibility into and no control over. One of the reasons I've never used my Apple email account as my main email account is because I have learned so many hard lessons about their spam filtering. A, that's not good at filtering spam, and B, it has stopped me from receiving legitimate messages many times with no explanation and no recourse. So I don't like Apple's email service for that reason, but a lot of people use it and find it fine. Anyway, SpamSieve I used for years, but of course, Alan has identified the problem. SpamSieve is a thing that runs on your Mac. For it to do its work, it needs to be running, and it only works on the Mac that it's running on. That was good for the days of POP, before we had even IMAP, where all the email was just downloaded onto each individual Mac. That's not the world we live in, although SpamSieve is really good, and it's tunable and configurable, and if you are in a situation where, and if you're using it with IMAP, it will be reflected back up on the server, obviously, because when it files things in spam, it's filing them in an IMAP spam folder. So SpamSieve is not just for POP, so I do actually recommend that, but if you're not running your Mac, then SpamSim isn't doing its work. And if you don't have an always-on Mac, I see the problem there. Mailroute, former sponsor of the show ages and ages ago, that I'm still using, is a server-side mail filtering service where you basically have your mail delivered to Mailroute, and then they filter spam and then forward it on to where it was really supposed to go. I like that because it runs on a server that I don't have to deal with someplace else. It's basically transparent. It doesn't matter what mail client you use or whatever, because as far as your client is concerned, when the mail arrives, it's already been filtered. And I think they do a pretty good job. I use that for a bunch of my like non-Gmail account things, and it blocks a lot of spam. And I never need to do anything with it. Now, does it block all the spam? No, but it has rarely caught a message that I wanted to get through. And it does send digest emails saying, here's some messages that we're questionable about, and you can click on individual ones and say, no, let that one through. I don't know if it learns from me doing that, but every once in a while I have to say, no, let that one through. Anyway, Mailroute, that's another option. I'm sure there are similar services like that. That's what I would look into. Instead, you know, if you don't have something that's running all the time where you can run SpamSieve on a Mac or whatever, look for a server-side solution that runs on a server that you do not run. Like, again, you could just go to Fastmail, as Casey was suggesting, which would do presumably all of this for you, but if you want to assemble your mail life experience from pieces, and why am I using Mailroute? Why don't I use it? Well, because I have a bunch of email addresses for domains that aren't real. I didn't want to use Google domains or anything like that. I just wanted them to be freestanding, and eventually I started getting enough email that spam became an issue, and I was looking for a solution to that, so I plugged in Mailroute, and it's so far been working for me, but I'm sure there are other alternatives.
Yeah, I would say I used Mailroute for a long time, and yeah, they were a sponsor, and my experience with them was pretty good overall. However, I did have to go in and like occasionally check their kind of like maybe quarantine to say, like, because there it would occasionally catch messages that I did want and flag them as spam, so I did have to kind of babysit it a little bit, but it did do a very good job of filtering out spam in the meantime. But overall, Casey is the most right among us. Don't do this. Don't run your email server in this day and age. There's lots of reasons that it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that in a way that is both you can, you know, reliably deliver mail to everybody and that you can reliably filter out spam. And
it's like the Cloudflare situation. Because it costs so little to send email, spam became prevalent, and then spam eventually overwhelmed all the legitimate mail. And that allowed a few powerful mail providers to become so big that then they could do deals amongst themselves about sort of mail exchange and who they'll trust and the rules that they're set. And now if you don't have a mail account on one of the big mail providers, it's very difficult to be independent. So now those big mail providers have an inordinate amount of control over the mail ecosystem. So whatever they decide to do amongst themselves, you are subject to that. If they just decide we're not going to accept any mail unless it does X, Y, and Z, you better do X, Y, and Z, or otherwise you can't deliver to millions and millions of people. And this is just another... Yeah, I mean, so it's two things. One, bad actors ruin stuff for everybody. And the bad actors in the Cloudflare case would be the AI crawlers that are crawling too aggressively. So they make an environment where we can't have nice things. Where it's, you know, someone's in there just making a mess and stomping around and breaking everything, and so you need someone to try to create order, and that creates these big powerful companies which now have too much power. So yeah, I'm sure, I don't know if this is tragedy of the commons or there's some common cliche or parable or lesson that repeats itself over and over again that I don't remember the name of that this is an example of.
All right. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace and Delete Me. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is you get to hear more of us every week in our ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. This week's Overtime, we're going to be talking about post-quantum cryptography, which is exactly as cool as it sounds. Post-quantum cryptography support in the 26 OSs in the networking stack. We're going to be talking about that. You can hear us by joining atp.fm/join. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
This is a safe space, right? I'm not loving that neither of you has confirmed that this is a safe space for me.
Yeah, no promises here. I think once you say what you have to say, once you give us the situation here, I want us all to do our counts.
Okay. I got home from the beach on Sunday, and we went out to dinner with some friends of ours, and I forget what was, I think it was like a late-breaking dinner in the sense that we hadn't really, really planned on going, and then all of a sudden it was like, all right, let's get in the car and go. And I was in my workout clothes, which is a ATP athletic shirt, you know, it's kind of Under Armour style athletic shirt that I love. And a pair of exercise shorts from a former sponsor, which I adore. I really, truly do. That being said, the zipper on these shorts has given up the ghost on both sides. So I don't generally go out and like do social things in this outfit, in no small part because I often stink, but here we are. But occasionally exceptions have to be made. And this is one of those exceptions. And so we went to dinner, and then I was getting back into Aaron's car in the passenger seat as I was leaving dinner. And Aaron said, oh, I just heard something fall. Was that your phone? To which I said, oh, no. Yes, it was. And sure enough, I shattered the back of my phone. This is, I believe, the third phone I've done this to. I had a very long stretch of never having done this. And then we had the incident where I jumped up to wash her former Volvo while I had the phone in a back pocket of regular shorts. Terrible decision, 100% my fault. And it shattered on the ground thereafter. And then I'm pretty sure I broke another one, although I don't recall how now. And then I think this is my third.
And to be clear, what is your case situation?
I am caseless, caseyless. And okay. I have dropped this phone several times, not on concrete like I did this time.
I don't know if you want to offer this this additional information.
No, I mean, I know full well the risk I'm taking. Yeah, I know right. full well the risk I'm taking. But
so you think your count is three. You have shattered
think
three phones.
That's right. And that one watch that also happened when washing.
We're not,
talking
about watches. This is yeah, just yeah. phones. It's not actually that. Because how many right. you've had an iPhone since what, the first one? The 3G?
The 3GS was my first.
Yeah, so that's a pretty good run for only three shattered phones. Although it is concerning that all three of them are fairly recent.
Semi-recent.
So
yeah, yeah.
Something has changed in your judgment about pockets
apparently,
or something?
I don't know. But I mean, this was ultimately my fault. It's still my fault. But I put myself in a position that I'm not usually in. I'm in a pair of shorts that I know is not the best phone containment mechanism. And I left the house, which is something I don't typically do in these shorts. And so it's my fault.
Well,
but
so what actually happened, though? Was the phone in your pocket and the yes. act of getting into the car squirted it out?
That's right.
Okay. So, what's your count, Marco?
My count of what?
How many phones have you shattered?
Zero.
I'm zero as well.
Not once, either of you? Wow, I'm impressed, genuinely.
I'm going to add iPod Touches because although I didn't get my first iPhone until the iPhone 7, I had the iPod Touch since the very first one, so I've always had phone-shaped things with screens on them, although granted, it probably didn't take the iPod Touch out of the house, although I did, but I had it in a pouch. You know. Anyway, I'm at zero.
I'm trying to think. I don't think I have ever broken an electronic device. I can't remember anything off the top of my head. Like maybe I'm forgetting something. But
didn't you sit on? Someone sat on an iPad in your house.
Someone did sit on an iPad in my house. It was
not your butt, huh?
No, it was a different okay. butt in the house.
All right. I don't think
I've ever broken anything like that.
I'm very impressed. Like I said, I had a very long run. This is coincidentally, I think this is actually all Stephen Hackett's fault. Because Stephen was breaking phones left and right for years, and I had never broken one. Now, to my recollection, Stephen hasn't broken a phone in a long time.
Did he start using Case?
Maybe. I don't know.
He traded. He started using exactly. Case You Stopped.
Exactly. No, that's right. I just listened to Connected, and I believe he said he's caseless in the winter, if I recall correctly, and case in the summer. So it would have saved me if I had followed his.
And by the way, speaking of the sounds of phones hitting the ground, once your children get a little older, you will start to become more familiar with that sound. I cannot count the number of times that I can now recognize whose phone it is. And where
Jesus.
They're dropping in the house, the phones have been dropped down the stairs, dropped onto the floor, just like onto the concrete. Like what you're getting into a car and falling out onto the ground has happened so many times. Thus far, I believe cases have saved it in all circumstances, although there's a very deep scratch on my daughter's phone screen. She says she doesn't know where it came from, but I'm not surprised because it's dropped all the time. Like, she's literally dropped it down the stairs, like, boom, hits, you know, like from the top of the stairs to the bottom, hitting all the stairs on the way down, and somehow to survive with just an Apple Clear case on it. That phone is getting replaced with her graduation gift / college phone, because she's used this phone for, like, 5 years, I think, 4 or 5 years, so she's getting a new phone to go off to college. But it's been a trooper. But yeah, you'll probably be more familiar with that sound.
Oh, I'm sure.
What I'm saying is, get cases for your kids' phones.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. And that will be a requirement. But I was doing the, you know, Apple Care is my case, which I do not advise. I do not advise this. This is insanity.
I mean, it seemed to work out for you because in the notes here, like, you had Apple Care on it, right?
I did. So I did an express replacement because I've learned from my mistakes with regard to the AirPods.
That's why you dropped it, because you just wanted to use the knowledge you had gained from past episodes.
Shoot, and now that I think about it, I could have written off the $30, whatever it is, to repair it. But what I did was that night, which was Sunday night, I went on Apple's website and said, I would like a express replacement, please. You know, I've broken the back glass, blah, blah, blah. That was easy peasy. It arrived yesterday, which is Tuesday. I did the transfer, which took forever. No matter what I do to transfer phones, I always make the wrong choice, and it always takes forever.
You just
have
a lot of data.
I was about to say, I think some of that is I just have a lot of data, but some of that I think I'm just making maybe not the best choice. But either way, it did transfer. Most everything worked just fine. I didn't have any major issues. Then I wiped the old phone, put it in the box that the new phone came in, dropped it off this morning at FedEx. And the way this works is there is a $1,300 hold on my credit card, because if I don't return the old phone, they basically think that I've stolen one, so they're going to bill me for it, which, fair enough. But sometime in the next, you know, 24 to 48 hours, presumably they will get the old phone, they will look at it and laugh at my misfortune, and then they will refund, or I guess release, all but $30 in order to, because I'm pretty sure the repair is $30. It used to be a lot more for the back glass, now it's $30. And I got to tell you, Apple Express replacement, I wish I had listened to everyone when they've told us this numerous times over the years, but it was pretty great. I don't have any particular problem with my local Apple store. They're always very nice there. They're usually relatively quick, despite serving a tremendous geographic area, as I've whined about many times on the show, but it worked out pretty great. So I really do suggest, if you are in a position where you can do an express replacement for a product, you should give it a shot. It worked out well.
I think also regarding you dropping your phone and being lucky enough to shatter the back glass, I think a lot of people would just put a case in that phone and just keep using it. I mean, obviously if they didn't have Apple Care, but even if they did, because I see so many people using phones with shattered screens, which I don't advise, yeah. But shattered back, it's like, oh, I'll just put a case in that and just forget it even exists, right?
That's true, but if I were to get a case, I would want some sort of leather case, maybe not the exact one that you like, but something similar. And that's the cost of two replacements of the back.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm not saying that you should. You had Apple Care, you should get a new phone. But I think a lot of people without Apple Care would have just chosen to continue using that phone. It's like, I see a lot of beat up phones in the world.
Oh, absolutely. If I had to pay the like $400 or whatever it is in August when I'm likely to get a new phone, let me check my math, next freaking month, there's no chance I would have got this repaired. But that being said, I do intend to pass this down to either family members or perhaps resell it or what have you, maybe trade it in. And so because of that, I would like it to be in at least decent shape when that happens. And so, I presumably will be eventually billed $30, which kudos to Apple for bringing that down from, I think it used to be $100 on for the back glass. Now it's $30, I believe. Maybe I'm in for a rude awakening, but I'm pretty sure that's right. And it was basically zero time without a phone. Well, I guess it was the 2 hours it took the phone to transfer, which I feel like if I were to go to the Apple store, maybe they would replace the back glass, but it wouldn't surprise me if they just handed me a refurb there as well. So one way or another, again, Express Replacement gets two thumbs up if you already are paying for Apple Care.
And you got a fresh battery for your kids or whoever gets that phone next.
Also thought about that too. Very true.
I mean, the really remarkable thing is that, you know, like if you totaled your car and then within a few years you totaled two other cars, I would be surprised if your insurance company continued to want your business. In this case, it is kind of remarkable that Apple isn't dropping you from Apple Care.
You know, I never thought of it that way, but you're not wrong.
The risk is spread over a very large risk pool of billions of iPhone users, so I'm not sure they're going to start narrowing it down to finding people who are prone to breaking phones, because we just all pay for all our Apple Care plans that we pay for that don't result in any kind of repair. That helps pay for the Caseys of the world. That's how risk pools work.
Anyway, so yeah, that is my follow-up, if you will, about Express Replacement. You should try it. Titles. You know what I didn't mention, though, is that I'm on my like sixth screen protector or something like that.
Yeah, well, that is just, obviously it's a bad screen protector that doesn't agree with your life, but you're just like, if you keep giving me free ones, I'll keep taking them.
Exactly.
That's the thing. Like, at a certain point, like, you should just maybe try a different screen protector. Maybe for your next phone.
Well, no, but here's the thing. I actually had this conversation with myself because I thought I was going to, quote unquote, lose my screen protector because it didn't. I didn't think it was damaged during the fall. It was all in the back. And I'm not going to even though I would like to, I'm not unfair or untruthful enough to deliberately damage it so I can send the picture to Belkin to be like, oh, guess what? It's broken. As it turns out, though, there was a little bit of damage on the front that I just didn't see it at first. And so just seconds ago, as we were recording, I got the email from Belkin saying they're sending me what I think is literally my fifth or sixth screen protector. And I thought
Belkin's
going
to be the one who drops you to be like, sorry.
Yeah, no, 100%. 100%. But that being said, I was thinking, Mel, you know, these Belkin ones, to your point, John, I'm constantly freaking breaking them. And some of that is surely on me, but some of that may be the screen protector. And I thought about doing like one of these other ones. Like, I forget which one it was. I can look it up. But somebody had recommended a particular kind of screen protector, like just strong recommendation for a different kind of screen protector. And I think they had like two in the screen protector box that you buy. Now, granted, I think this one was like 10 or 15 bucks. The Belkin one was like 40. But two apparently is not enough for me, and I don't think most other screen protectors do this like basically infinite conga
more
line.
Than one in the box doesn't give me hope that it's going to be very sturdy.
Exactly,
it's like they're sending to you knowing it's going to break.
Well, I think it's more like whenever I get screen protectors like from Amazon Brando brands, they always come in batches of like six for, you know, $9. Like, I think the reality is screen protectors just don't really cost anything to make and it's fine. Like, they don't really care if they throw in a bunch of extras, you know, compared to like the cost of, so you know, obviously one of the challenges of screen protectors is if you apply it and you get a speck of dust under it, you know, sometimes you can fix it, sometimes you can't, sometimes you just kind of like ruin one, you gotta try again. And like, imagine all the people who would like be angry and leave one star reviews if they only had one or whatever, and they're like, oh, well, we gave you two, and so you can just try again. And like, I bet it's worth the companies who make these things like giving a bunch of extras in lots of cases, because it, you know, it's just so cheap. It's, you know, no sweat off their back. Meanwhile, you know, the customers have better experiences with them and you feel like you're getting a good deal.
Yeah. All right. Titles.
I think, not per my request, I like your judgment about pockets.
Let's see. I think I like not per my request more, but I'm not against the pockets one.
Let's see. I like when John said you can see the big boxes. That was in terms of disk space apps.
I like that one too. Any of these are good with me. I don't have any clear winner personally.
I'm good. I think my favorite is pockets.
Yeah, we can do that. It's late though. It's an after show one, and that's fine with me. But
to commemorate Casey's third.
I think so.
Third?
I think so.
We don't know. That's the problem. Casey's unreliable narrator. We don't.
Yeah, well.
We're not a reliable source for his breaking.
I'm consistently unreliable.
Maybe
though.
Aaron
How about
will
that?
You should text her.
She's probably asleep, to be honest with you. All right. Vamp for a second while I get this ready to go to overtime.
Cool.
Apple Express replacement.
How's it going?
We're in Delaware.
You should let me, I want to give a preface to the overtime. You can launch it open the throat to me for a second and then before you dive into the text.
Okay. All right. We are normal time next week, as far as I know. So, live people, we will see you later.
Cool. Bye, live people.